Hey everyone, before we get started, just want to say that today's episode is brought to you by the Sound Solution Project by Black Swamp Percussion. The Sound Solution Project is a two-week educational event put on by Black Swamp Percussion, starting August 17th and going through the 31st. The Sound Solution Project features educational and performance video content from the Black Swamp Percussion Shop and with Black Swamp artists and educators. Black Swamp is offering 15% through Steve Weiss Music and launching two performance packs for students and educators. Visit blackswamp.com/soundsolutionproject or follow Black Swamp Percussion online for all the latest in details and video content. Okay, let's hear the drums. Hello and welcome to Pete's Percussion Podcast. I'm your host, Pete Zambito, and we're here with episode 203 and my conversation with Colorado State University instructor of jazz studies and drum set and freelance musician Shiloh Stroman. It is mid-August, which means we are in band camp. Marching Mizzou is currently working under all of the normal conditions, which in 2020 means that we're practicing active social distancing, having all members wear masks, operating at half capacity for playing instruments, keeping everything clean and sanitized, and using wipes at all times, and all of that. Again, the usual, it is 2020. We're keeping things rolling as best we can, and we have been gifted with actually decent August weather. We continue onward and upward as the semester begins, and we hope that we're able to provide all students with a quality education in what will be a truly unusual semester starting next week. All right, let's get to Shiloh. Shiloh Stroman was suggested to me by recent podcast guest Josh Gottry. Shiloh has been very active as a freelancer, percussionist, educator, drum set artist, adjudicator, and clinician. He's recently been putting out a consistent Instagram video series on improvisation, as well as videos through Yamaha on fundamentals. He's a consistent performer locally in and around the Colorado State campus, along with working as a ranger and electric bass player. We get into all of that and a lot more in this interview, so let's get to it. We recorded this interview over Skype on August 7th, 2020, and it begins right now. So, Shiloh, give me a summation of your percussion activities as they are right now.
So I am a senior instructor at Colorado State University in Fort Collins, Colorado, where I kind of teach a little bit of jazz, a little bit on the ed side, and a little bit on the percussion side. So I kind of do a little bit of everything there, which is super fun. And then I am the artistic director and front ensemble arranger and caption head at the Battalion Drum and Bugle Corps, which is based in Salt Lake City, Utah. And then I do a ton of arranging, both indoor and outdoor, full band stuff, percussions stuff, a little bit of sound design. And then I do quite a bit of playing, mostly jazz drum set, but occasionally other things. I play jazz vibes, and I also play electric bass. So I kind of do that as far as gigging is concerned.
What got you to Colorado State in the first place?
It's a long story with my undergrad, but I did end up getting my undergraduate degree from there. And then the music department really took on a transformation. They got a new building, and they hired basically almost the entire faculty kind of switched over, and a new percussion instructor was there, and his name is Eric Hollenbeck. Mm-hmm. And I was out teaching kind of part-time in the public schools and gigging, and I decided I wanted to go back and get my master's, especially because he was in town and I really enjoyed everything that he brought to the table. So I went and got my master's with him, and then he needed some help with his, because he was growing the percussion studio so much that he needed some help. So I was able to kind of get on with a really small appointment, just teaching a couple private lessons. And then that's grown to where I am now.
Was this all drum set that it was beginning, or jazz based?
Yeah, it was all jazz based. Basically, Eric and I, like, his strengths are my weaknesses and vice versa. So we make a really good team in that regard. So I was, yeah, teaching jazz drum set and teaching some jazz vibes, things like that. And then that's grown, like I said, to my position today.
So yeah. What are the kind of the full range of classes that you teach there?
So I teach lessons, of course. I teach the freshman, we call it seminar class, which is basically first semester. And that's when they, I kind of get them introduced to the college life and how to practice. And I focus on accessory instruments a lot because that seems to be a deficiency when we have students coming in, things like that. I teach the percussion methods class. I teach the jazz pedagogy class. I teach the second big band. And then I oversee the graduate student for the marching band, which basically I do a lot of the recruiting, a lot of the emails and things like that. And then I also tend to write one or two shows, do all the audition process, that kind of thing. And then once the season really gets going, it's really the grad student's baby. But really before that, in the interim between graduate students, I really do quite a bit of work there. So I think that's everything I do.
Yeah. I'm curious, because your title says special assistant professor.
Yeah.
Is that a specific title to the school? Like, in terms of, I mean, there's like, because sometimes it's listed as like lecturer, teaching, like there's different ways that schools note these things.
You probably are looking at an older bio. I literally just got the special instructor kind of promotion in July, and they restructured everything at CSU. So that special assistant professor doesn't even exist anymore. I'm at basically a similar level, but a different title because they restructured the titles. So yeah, confusing, I know.
Gotcha. So what ends up being kind of the progression of classes that you're teaching? I'm hoping that you're not, are you teaching all of those every semester?
No. Oh, I also teach jazz history. I forgot about that.
Oh, wow.
So most of my course, like heavy course academic kind of courses, are in the fall. So the fall is actually crazy busy for me. And then the spring is actually quite light. So it's really, it's just balanced that way. That's the way it turns out, which is fine. So yeah, I teach jazz history, jazz pedagogy, and percussion methods all in the fall. And then in the spring, and then marching band, et cetera. And then in the spring, I teach jazz band and lessons, and that's, and then sometimes percussion ensemble, depending on how things are, that kind of takes place of that freshman seminar class in the spring.
So your involvement with the, with marching band there is mostly a prep or a summer, like get everything rolling. And then you kind of like lay off, I guess, for a better term.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the way, because Eric actually used to teach the drum line too. That was a part of his gig when he first got there. And then the percussion studio got so big, they needed somebody else. So yeah, I do a lot of, you know, like the recruiting and emailing and things like that. And then obviously every 2 years we have a new graduate student. So there's a lot that has to take place in that transition period. And then I do, you know, I'm there for auditions and band camp and things like that. And then, yeah, once really like first day of school starts, my position's kind of done. I still go out there and make sure the grad student's doing all right. And, you know, if they need any assistance and making sure the kids are having a good time. So,
yeah. So you drive around in your car, you give a thumbs up, and then you drive around.
No, it's kind of more like if I'm walking out of school after jazz history and I hear like a bad tap off or some nasty left hands or something, I walk out.
Exactly. It's just like, what?
No, I can't not go over there.
Musk, correct now.
No, they're really fun kids, but it's a big group, and it's so, yeah, I kind of poke my head around and make sure everything's cool.
Yeah, no, I hear you. Tell me a little bit about, obviously it's different now with COVID, and I'll ask you more about that in a sec. But what's the kind of been the gigging city situation there?
Fort Collins is actually a very musical city. We have a foundation here in town called the Bohemian Foundation, and they are a nonprofit that funds a ton of musical activities. There's actually this center called the Music District, which has practice rooms and teaching spaces and performance spaces and recording studios and things like that. And then obviously the school, and then there's tons of live music. There's like four jazz venues in this town that have jazz on a regular basis. It just depends from one to basically 5 days a week. So it's crazy. So there's quite a bit of music happening in this town specifically, and really all along the Front Range of Colorado. It's a pretty music, pretty good music scene. It's really cool. And so basically, as soon as things could start opening up, people were gigging, which was really amazing. All outside, of course. There's a drive-in theater here in town that has been having live music, I think one or two nights a week for the past month, I think. Clubs that do have like big patios and things like that have been having live music. The Colorado Symphony just did a show at Red Rocks, and it was, you know, very small attendance, obviously. I saw pictures of it. It was just like, you know, a blanket of a family and then, you know, 20 feet and then another family and things like that. So yeah, things are coming back, which is obviously super encouraging. I think people, it just shows kind of how important music is to at least this community. And people really wanted it back as soon as possible, which is cool.
In some ways it's been forever. And in some ways when I think we had one of our outdoor venues in town, I'm in Columbia, Missouri. And, we had one of our downtown venues opened, and I was walking by it, and I was just like, oh, it's like, it was like, oh, it's back, you know?
Yeah.
It's been 4 months.
Right. Yeah. And so, you know, there's the other thing people have been doing, like there's a big jazz club in Denver called Dazzle. And they partnered with one of the good recording studios in town, and they've been doing live streams and, you know, virtual tip jars and things like that. So that's been something that's been happening too, really since kind of the early parts of the quarantine, but the live, where you can actually go sit and watch live stuff has definitely come back, recently with a big surge, which has been cool.
Yeah. No, that's great. Because you have a lot of things that are related to drum corps in various ways. Obviously the shutdown has taken away an enormous amount of, of your career and livelihood, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, what's that been? I mean, obviously not great.
Yeah. I mean, the worst part for us is, the battalion, this is our, was going to be our first time going to Indy for championships.
Yeah.
So that was a huge letdown, obviously, for us. And we had a really good synergy going. We had a great show. It's probably the most coordinated show we've ever had. We worked really hard on it. We had a great bunch of students at auditions. And then, you know, we just had so much momentum headed towards Indy. So that was a huge bummer.
And hold on. How long has that core been around?
So this is our fifth year of competing.
Gotcha.
Yeah, we were around technically, you know, for a year previous for nonprofit status and all those kinds of things. So yeah, that was going to be amazing. And obviously, it was a letdown not to do that. It's been cool. Every school that I've written for and the drum corps as well, they've been great about paying me still, and they're going to use those shows next year or, you know, whatever. Everybody was kind of the mindset, like, you did the work, here's your money, and then we'll figure out what happens next year.
Yeah.
Which I was cool with, because I have time to plan for next year. If there's going to be a financial hit next year, I have time to plan. I obviously didn't have time to plan this year if that was going to happen. So it was really great. I worked with a lot of great directors, and everybody at the drum corps is great. The bummer, you know, a lot of my friends who write drill, that was not the case, because, you know, if you're not doing a show with drill, then you didn't get paid, kind of thing. So I've heard various degrees of stories, I guess, is how I would put it.
Does that include your writing for high schools too?
Yeah. So all the high school people I wrote for, there was various stages of things. So it took a while for Colorado to make the call that we weren't going to do marching season. So at first they actually made all the shows really short to try and alleviate some pressure there and thinking the season would be shorter. So I kind of rewrote some stuff or didn't start on time and just like kicked it out really quickly. Cause some groups still had band camps and things like that. And then everybody was just cool. Like some people paid me up front. Some people were just like, we're going to use it next year. Here's your money. So that's been great. and like I said, I can at least plan for next year if we're in a similar situation or whatever. So
you're, again, I'm looking at the bio that's on your webpage, whether, like you said, whether that's as updated as possible is fine. But the, you're right. Your composition writing has been primarily for, drum corps kind of style.
I've written some stuff for, there's a chamber group here in town called NoCo Artists.
Okay.
And I've written some stuff for them, and that's, you know, like strings and woodwinds and things like that. And then I've written some stuff for my own jazz quartet, and I released a CD. I don't remember what that was now, a while ago. And then I turned one of those pieces into a big band chart last year for my big band at CSU. And then actually sent it to a couple high school directors, friends of mine who wanted to play it too. So, yeah, I kind of dabble in everything. If there's an opportunity to do something, I'll take it.
Sure.
Yeah.
The jazz group is people in town?
Yes.
That you met just generally gigging and all that stuff.
Exactly. Yep.
Yeah. With Colorado State, what has been the progression of the summer in terms of trying to get ready for school and then the kind of the, whatever the marching band is trying to do?
It seems to be kind of changing on a daily basis in some way.
Yeah.
In some ways not. So the plan as of right now that I know of this moment is that we are going back to in-person classes, but very small and socially distanced and, you know, some different class settings. From what I know right now, we still will have marching band. It'll be 2 days of a camp versus, you know, a typical week. And then there are some plans for game day, but we will not be on the field. I know that. But like I said, that's kind of seems to be ever changing and different emails and things like that. So there's been a ton of emails as far as like technology is concerned, though. So because right now our plan is to go in person up till Thanksgiving break. We have a fall break, a whole week. And then after that, we'll be online.
Mm-hmm.
So we've still been making plans for that too, like getting technology in place and kind of restructuring our schedule as far as like when things are going to take place and stuff like that.
Yep.
Cause there's not much, you know, after Thanksgiving break as far as school time. Yeah. So, but that's kind of what I know as of now at this second.
Yeah. I understand. As far as you know, in terms of the protocols for marching band, do you all have like a cap in terms of how many students can be at a rehearsal?
Yeah. Yep. And we've already started making plans for all of that as well. You know, kind of the easiest portion of that is the drum line.
Sure.
So like my job is not too much different than we might just have some bigger intervals.
Of course. Yeah.
But other than that, it's kind of similar, which is nice. The rehearsal schedule is obviously different as far as time allotment. Obviously we can't go inside ever.
Yeah.
So those parts are different, but other than that, it's similar, I guess.
Mm-hmm. What conference are you all in?
Oh, geez.
I didn't know there'd be any sports in the show.
No, sorry. I can't remember right now. It just left me. I'll think of it. But
is it WAC?
What's that?
WAC, Western Athletic Conference.
No, we left that one. I think are we in the Mountain West now? Is that right?
That sounds right.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you.
Okay.
I don't know of anything that I've heard from that conference yet. So, but that seems to be changing every day too. So,
yeah. Do you all, does the marching band have a dedicated indoor space, or do they kind of just roll with it if they need it?
We have a large band room, but it's not that big, you know, it's not oil. So we do take over that space, and we do have a stage that we will use during band camp only. But yeah, I mean, if we have bad weather, we just cancel rehearsal.
Yeah,
this year. So,
and as far as you know, right now your classes are kind of in the same kind of pattern of meeting either hybrid or like in person, but they're capped at a certain amount, kind of thing.
Yeah, so like my jazz history class usually has 35 is the cap on it, which is, you know, a big class.
Yeah.
For the classrooms that we have at the music building. So I'm taking the biggest classroom in the building so we can, you know, socially distance and all that. So that has changed. Some of my other classes are small enough and or in big enough rooms that it's not that big of a deal. The jazz ensemble will be only 10 people instead of, you know, our typical jazz band size.
There's a lot, like 25?
Yeah, there's usually, you know, like 15-ish winds and then rhythm section.
Oh, sure. 20, yeah, about 20.
So we're only going to have 10 now. So it'll be 3 saxes, 2 trombones, 2 trumpets, and in rhythm. Mm-hmm. So that'll be different. Percussion ensemble, we're only doing like quartets, basically.
Yeah.
And then some of the meeting times are changing. We're like using, like, we'll be teaching till 8 or 9 at night. Instead of even on some weekends and stuff. So
that you can all use the same larger spaces, basically.
Yeah. Because we were told, I think that's a Larimer County Health thing, that we're supposed to maintain like half the building capacity as much as possible or at all times or something like that.
Yep.
Yeah.
Got it.
So they're working on scheduling right now, which I can't even imagine. So
yeah. We had a meeting yesterday. I'm at Mizzou, and our meeting yesterday was trying to figure, part of it was explaining what's happening with the vocal studios. Basically accompanists have to do all their work and record it and send it to the people they're accompanying. Dedicated practice rooms to specific, for specific studios, everyone's schedule has to be more regimented, as I think you're realizing.
Yeah. Which, I mean, it's going to be, I mean, I'm sure you'll find this as a challenge as well. Like, I'm used to trying to put all my lessons like back to back to back.
Right.
So I don't have to be there like all day.
Yeah.
And things. So all of that's going to change. And, I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, we nobody knows. That's where we're at.
Exactly.
Shiloh, let's back up. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Windsor, Colorado, actually, which is only about 20 minutes from Fort Collins. So I've been kind of a Northern Colorado person my whole life.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do you have any family members in the arts?
Not in the arts, no. My mom is a vocalist. She was in like a chamber group here, and actually not a chamber group, but it's like a large choir, like a community choir here in town for a while that she enjoyed. She's like done funerals and weddings. She sang at those before. So, but not like, you know, a dedicated full-time musician or anything like that, but yeah.
So when did you get the percussion bug? Or whichever bug hit you first.
Well, my dad always wanted to be a drummer, and he did kind of in high school, but he never learned how to read music or anything like that. So somehow I got interested in drums at 5 years old, and he got me like one of those toy drum sets from Target or whatever. And I went through 2 of those because they're terrible. Yeah, right. And I played them with chopsticks because like the drumsticks broke, because I don't remember. Anyway. And they finally got me like a real drum set at a garage sale, which was one of those, it was like a bass drum, a rack tom, a snare drum, and like a cymbal and a hi-hat or something like that.
Uh-huh.
And then I got like my first kind of real drum set in middle school, and it kind of, yeah, took off from there. Started taking lessons in middle school when I was in 7th grade. And yep, here we are.
Have you ever seen the video of Mike Portnoy playing a Hello Kitty drunk hit?
Yes, I have. I don't know if I watched the whole thing, but yes, I have seen that.
It's great. I mean, he like destroys it, obviously. But
they're absolutely terrible. It's like paper.
That's always, I always think of that whenever anyone talks about like a Walmart drum set or, you know, stuff like that.
Yep.
So when you start taking lessons, are they drum set, snare? Are you taking all percussion? What's the kind of the focus?
It was a little bit of everything for the first couple of years, I think. And then I was taking from graduate students at the University of Northern Colorado. And so obviously they were kind of rotating every couple of years. So I had quite a few teachers, which was really cool actually, to get different takes on things. So I would work on like what I was supposed to do for school, obviously like snare drum tests or bell tests and things like that. Haskell Haar book, you know, like standard kind of stuff. And then a ton of drum set. Yeah.
Who were you first influenced by there?
As far as like
drum set.
My first two jazz recordings ever that I like got for Christmas, was an Art Blakey and the Jazz Messengers kind of best of cassette. Sweet. And then a Dave Weckl cassette.
Oh my gosh.
Oh no, sorry. It was Chick Corea's Electric Band. That was what it was. So, but with Weckl. Mm. So obviously like extremely diverse, like opposite ends of the spectrum.
Yeah. But
the first two actual like jazz recordings I owned personally. My mom listened to Manhattan Transfer.
That's like, a little different too.
My dad had a ton of records like Beatles, Elvis, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then believe it or not, my first concert that I ever went to was Barry Manilow at Red Rocks.
Nice.
My mom was a huge Barry Manilow, well, still is a huge Barry Manilow fan. Mm-hmm. And I had like all of those on 8-track.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Along with Loggins and Messina and some other.
I didn't get into Kenny Loggins until Footloose came out.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
And I saw him at NAMM this last year and he killed it. He still sounds awesome.
Yeah.
Yeah, it sounds great. That's kind of my where I started. And then one of my teachers would make recordings for me on like I would just bring him blank cassettes.
Mm-hmm.
And he, obviously totally illegal and it sounds terrible now, but
sure.
Would make cassette recordings for me because this is right around when CDs kind of started coming out, so you can make like good recordings. And so I got into like some really crazy stuff. And very diverse. I wouldn't even ask him. He would just basically like, listen to this. So it was like Erskine and Mark Johnson and John Abercrombie and like Primus and like a really diverse group of artists, which was very cool.
Oh yeah. Like when you think of, it's a lot of Tom work because you're listening to Blakey and Weckl. So you have that, and then you get like all the double bass stuff from Primus.
Yeah.
So that's in there. It's good. Yeah, that's nice. It's a nice range. And then Barry Manilow, you know, mean, the guy writes the songs that the whole world sings. So there you go.
It's true. Got that Barry Manilow key change at the end of every tune, you know?
Sure. I was hanging out with a friend yesterday. We were talking, he was started to sing something from Into the Woods.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, oh yeah, and it's like the Sondheim key change where they sing the same exact notes, but then it changes right after that. And it gets like a touch sharp. And we were like, it was like, oh, it was perfect.
Yeah, absolutely. My name is actually from a Neil Diamond song. So I listened to a lot of Neil Diamond when I was
Oh yeah. Well, it's without the H, right?
Yeah, and actually, if I remember correctly, his doesn't have an H on it either, but I can't remember.
But it's a slightly different spelling.
It might be. And there's actually two versions of that tune, which I didn't know. One has an extra verse. But I saw Neil Diamond quite a bit live, too. And
yes.
With Ron Tutt on drums, who was
Elvis's drummer, right?
Yeah, so that was, you know, and I didn't really know any of that until later, and I'm reading Modern Drummer like, oh my God, I've seen that guy live. Like, that's crazy. And that was Elvis's drummer, who's one of my dad's favorite like musicians, like all of this nerdy drum set lore, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, so that's kind of my early background in music. And then it branched off from there for sure.
So this is good. You're getting me into a zone here and talk about Neil Diamond. It's like, yes. Yeah.
Well, and that's, you know, Neil Diamond and Barry Manilow, obviously they kind of get a bad rap sometimes and stuff, but dude, their shows were amazing.
Yeah.
Like the sets and the costumes and the crowd energy and like, and they're selling, back then it was McNichols Arena.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Or Red Rocks, you know, it's like, dude, they're selling those places out and it was great.
They got the sparkly suit jackets and, and he plays his he kind of holds the guitar out so he can play like the big open chords and right into Cherry and so good.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, and there was a, I watched like on PBS, they had one of his last, what probably is one of his last live concerts, which was from 2012, I think. But his band is all studio guys or people who have their own gigs.
Yeah.
So it's like he's got it's all pros, and so it sounds great.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yep. A store in Denver called Pro Sound. It's not there anymore. Hasn't been for years, but they would bring in some pretty crazy clinicians that I got to see, and so would UNC. UNC has a huge jazz festival every spring. So I got to see Art Blakey like about a year before he died, and I could see Vinny Colaiuta in clinic, which as an eighth grader, I didn't understand anything he was talking about. But that's amazing, you know?
I would watch Vinny Colaiuta now and I'd be like, I still don't know what's going on.
Yeah. It's funny. I got into an argument. Well, not an argument, but I was at a jazz gig here in town, and on break, I was at the bar, just chatting people up, whatever. And this guy was like, well, he's like, obviously Neil Peart's the best drummer alive, you know, obviously when he was still alive. And I kind of just snickered, and this guy was like, what, you don't think? And I was like, no, Vinnie Colaiuta is the best drummer on the planet. Like he can literally do everything. You know, he can play in a metal band. He can play brushes. He can play in 17/8. You know, I mean, he can literally do whatever you ask that man to do.
Right.
It sounds great. And you would be like, that's stylistically correct.
Yeah.
You know, but of course this guy is just a kind of average music fan and didn't even know who he was or whatever.
Yeah.
So it was a moot argument, but
right. No, I hear you. That's good. I like that. That's a good, well, actually moment. I was like, well, actually, it's
right.
All you do is the correct answer. So.
Correct. And in my opinion, anyway.
Yeah. And there's like, there's like 15 other drummers I'll get to before, and then, you know, then we'll talk about Neil Peart.
Exactly. I mean, you hear Vinny on like a Faith Hill record, and you're like, man, that's slamming. He's just playing pocket the whole time.
Yeah.
And then you hear him. I saw this thing from the Baked Potato recently, and it was just like jaw-droppingly good. Yeah. Him soloing in some crazy time signature. You know, it's just like, wow. But then, yeah, I mean, he could swing a big band and play brushes. Yeah. Sounds great. So.
He was on there was a concert recently, again, also PBS, with Herbie Hancock, and he was playing drum set. Yeah. With and it was way, very, very, and it was definitely a more out there Herbie.
Yeah.
You've seen, I assume, the thing with that's Vinny and Weckl and Gad, that that video from the 80s.
Oh yeah.
So I would show that to students when I first was made aware of it. I'd show that to students, and you know, the Weckl was like, you know, it was a little bit underwhelming compared to the other two, and Gad would put the grooves in that were just like disgusting. They were so good. And then when Vinny would come on, they would just be like, they would pass out because they
When I became a Yamaha artist is when their Maple Hybrid drums kind of just came out.
Mm-hmm.
And they had that like they call it antique white, which I remember Vinny's like Yamaha ad from like those days, and he played that white drum set.
Oh yeah
that's why I bought that color.
Right. Yeah.
So I was like, I want to pretend that I'm Vinny, at least.
Yeah, with the black heads.
Yeah. And after that, the, you know, the comparison stopped, but I have the same color.
But step one, I have the drum set.
Got the drums, baby. Yeah.
As you progress through high school, are you doing kind of all of the range of typical percussion activities with band and drum set and concert percussion as well, or not as much?
So my school was fairly small. There was only about 400 kids in it. So we only had one band and one jazz band. And so I was, you know, I wasn't a great mallet player and I wasn't really doing a lot of that in high school, to be honest with you. I did enough to like make all state and stuff like that, all state orchestra and those kinds of things. And our jazz band, we had three really good drummers. And we had keyboard bass. Do you remember keyboard bass? With like the little, it's about this big and it just has like an octave and change of bass clef. And
I think I know it. Yeah. Okay. I know what you're talking about.
Which sounds terrible. It's awful. So you know, in the rotation of drummers, like I didn't get to play very much. So I told my band director, if you buy a bass, I'll learn how to do it. And that's how I learned how to do electric bass. He bought the school a bass and he bought a book. Mm-hmm. And I taught myself how to play electric bass. And then obviously got to play drums a little bit more once some of the older guys graduated and stuff like that. But, so I kind of did a little bit of everything, but I didn't really get to keyboards till I was a freshman in college, to be honest with you. I definitely didn't learn four mallets till I was a freshman in college. But I was a good sight reader. And you know, being in all state orchestra and all state jazz band and those kinds of things, that was amazing. And going to music camp in the summer, you know,
is that just locally that you were doing that?
Exactly. CSU. Yeah. And getting to play with like other really great high school musicians that had like similar nerdy qualities for the music and stuff like that. And
yeah,
knew who Art Blakey was, you know, that kind of thing. So that's kind of what my high school vibe was. And, you know, getting together and trying to play Red Hot Chili Peppers tunes with your friends and stuff like
that.
Yeah.
Good stuff.
Typical stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And what about the marching side?
Oh yeah. I played snare drum all 4 years of high school. I was way into it. My junior and senior year, this is way before like everybody had a drum instructor of some sort. So my junior and senior year, like I wrote the drum solo and that was like super fun and got me into arranging and stuff. And I basically like taught the drum line, you know, my junior and senior year, cause we didn't have anybody. It was just whoever was the upperclassman got to do it. And so, yeah, I definitely did a lot of that too.
So you threw yourself into the fire or offered yourself into the fire kind of thing? And
I mean, in some ways it was kind of like by default, like you're the section leader and the band director's like, do this. And you're like, okay.
When you were growing up, were you involved in anything outside of music, like sports or student government or anything like that to fill out your time?
I was involved in some sports in middle school. Not great. my sister's definitely the athlete in the family. She played college volleyball for a couple of years, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And I took golf lessons and I got into golf a little bit, but now I'm like way stupid into golf. I love it.
Oh.
So it kind of came around, you know, from when I was 9 years old. Now it's come all the way around again. Mm-hmm. What else did I do? I mean, we lived out in the country, so we did have like toys, like four wheelers and a go-kart and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I was into mountain biking and skateboarding.
Sweet.
In high school. So, and that all, that's kind of the other things I was into. Yeah.
Do you know what your handicap is?
Yeah, I'm a 14.
That's good.
Thanks.
No, seriously. What's your best shot? Good off the tee? Can you putt? How would you assess your golf game at this point?
It definitely depends on the day, man. Yeah. yesterday I went to the range and I could do no wrong. I was like striping balls straight as an arrow. I couldn't believe it. I wish somebody was there to witness it, you know?
Right. Yeah.
But I would say that I'm pretty good at like chipping and putting just because of the touch part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know? I'm pretty good out of the sand, actually.
Oh, good.
And I think a lot of that's just like being a drummer and the touch of it, you know, cause that's all like feel.
Yeah.
Where, you know, I know a 5-iron goes X amount of yards. If I hit it correctly, every time I know what it's going to do.
Sure.
But the other stuff, man, you just don't know.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it depends on how far up you got to chip out, particularly in bunkers.
Right.
That angle and how much sand you got to hit, all that stuff.
Absolutely.
Is there a lot of golf courses in the area?
Yeah, Northern Colorado has a lot of golf and some really nice courses. And all of Colorado has because the topography here is so interesting.
Yeah.
That literally you could play this two golf courses in the same city and they'll be completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So it's super fun in that regard. And a lot of the courses are really well maintained. And depending on the year, I've played golf the day after Christmas before. but also sometimes you can't play golf in October because it snowed. So right. Just depends.
Weather being what it is in various areas, I've always heard that Colorado is the most 30, 60, 90, 12. That was the temperature today.
Oh, yeah. 100% correct. Yeah. During indoor season, there was one Sunday where we were outside because it was so nice and it's easier to hear outside. And
mm-hmm.
The kids were boys had their shirts off and all that kind of stuff. And we're outside. It's literally almost 80 degrees in March. And then the next morning it dumped snow. And so I sent all my SoCal friends, cause they're always bragging, we're outside rehearsing and it's a little cold today cause it's 65. And I'm like,
right.
I sent them Sunday, Monday picture. I'm like, here's us rehearsing outside. Here's my car buried in snow.
Yeah. A foregone conclusion that you were going to Colorado State for undergrad?
I actually started at UNC in Greeley, Northern Colorado. And I didn't do so great, especially the ear training thing. And so I actually decided after my first year that I would go get all my general eds out of the way at a community college in called Ames, which was in Greeley. And they had this system where they would pay for me to play in ensembles at UNC, just one credit because they didn't offer it at Ames. It was kind of this weird little community college thing. So I still was able to play in a jazz band at UNC for the next couple of years while I finished my, my associate's degree and just got all my gen eds out of the way.
Mm.
And I had some amazing teachers at Ames, really hard classes but really, really good teachers. So that was really cool. And then that's when I transferred to CSU after that. And did better there because they use solfege
mm-hmm.
numbers, and that just helped me. And by then I was a little bit better with my ear and some things and knew more about music and stuff. So, yeah.
When you went to Northern Colorado, was it for the same thing that you ended up getting your undergrad in generally?
Yeah. Yeah. I got a performance degree in percussion. Yeah.
Okay. It just wasn't the focus there were other things that were happening.
You mean at the school or?
The focus of Northern Colorado wasn't what you wanted.
No, it really had nothing to do with that. I didn't do great in theory, basically my first semester. And then obviously that kind of pushes you back, I would go in for sight singing and the teacher would say, you have a 10 ear.
Right.
Yeah. So kind of getting all my gen eds out of the way and learn and hanging around musicians and learning more about theory and playing keyboards more, timpani more, that kind of stuff. Then I just was way more successful immediately at CSU and the solfege thing really, I could hear the difference between May and me, but three and three sounds the same.
I hear you. Yeah. I hear you.
So all of that stuff. And by then I was such a jazz nerd that the actual written part was so easy. I could identify chords really fast. And
mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was just, in some ways it was just timing,
But what do you mean?
Well, at UNC, I wasn't as successful cause I wasn't really ready for some of it,
I got you. Yeah. I understand that.
Yeah. I could sight read the heck out of a big band chart and I could play drum set and all that stuff. But some of the other stuff just wasn't ready yet. So, yeah.
When you go to Colorado State, who's the percussion professor at that point?
His name was David Johnson.
Okay.
And that, it was more like a, it wasn't a full-time gig or anything then.
Mm.
Yeah, it wasn't a tenure track or any of that stuff. So way different scene than now. Yeah, way different.
Got it. What were the facilities like when you were there as a student?
Way different. That building is now like a math mod class or something like that, where they just go in and take, or maybe it's a computer building. I don't remember. But it was way smaller. Like probably maybe a quarter of the size of the building we're in now, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the music school was much smaller back then too. So yeah, a lot has really changed and developed since the late 90s or mid to late 90s at CSU musically. Yeah.
Obviously you're saying that there's no full-time percussion professor, or at least not in the same way. So was there a studio experience? Was there an ensemble experience that was part of it?
Yeah. To be honest, I don't know like details of how he was paid and things like that, but
no, I understand that.
Yeah. But he did start a percussion ensemble. And then like some of the more experienced kids, like we would do rags and stuff, and we would go out and gig and play like Mexican marimba things and, you know, stuff like that. And then, he and I would actually started doing like the Friedman Samuels, like double image stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a small studio. I don't remember how many were actually majors, maybe 4 or 5. And then there were other people who were kind of involved in the studio, you know, on the outskirts, for lack of a better term, you know, who maybe just did concert band or drumline or something, but yeah.
Mm. Yeah. And were you doing the drumline there?
Yeah. Yeah. I played in the drumline there. Yeah.
Gotcha. Were you writing in the area while you were doing that or teaching during that time?
Yeah, I was doing a little bit of that for sure. I started doing that basically right after I graduated from high school. I started teaching my high school's drumline, just kind of free for fun. And then they actually made it a position, and that position is still there till this day, which is kind of cool to think about. And I wrote a little bit for the CSU line actually then too. Cause the instructor would just be like, hey, you kind of know the modern voice a little bit more. Would you write some stuff? And so I would write some stuff, all by pencil back then.
Yeah.
It kind of,
penmanship.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Good. Or did it like force you to be readable? I hope.
Yeah, I thought mine was pretty good until I saw Tom Hannum's, and I'm like, I'm terrible. Yeah, his scores are like beautiful to look at. Mine were not. I got the job done. So
yeah. Now, while you were going through your undergrad, were you doing DCI?
I never marched.
Hmm.
Yeah. Yep.
Considering all the drum corps stuff you do, that is a little surprising, at least.
Yeah. It's surprising to a lot of people. when I was thinking about auditioning, cause like when I was at UNC, we had a graduate student there who was writing for the Colts at the time. He was the horn arranger for the Colts.
Mm-hmm.
Man, I'm really interested in doing that. But then I started playing gigs and I was making money, and we got a gig like all summer long at this club in, one summer. And I was like, well, I can go make money or I can pay money to march. I'm like, well, that's kind of just a no-brainer. So I never did march. I never did indoor either. It just didn't really work with the school schedule back then. It's different now. It tends to work a little bit better. But
well, how prevalent was it back then?
The indoor thing?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's huge here because Blue Knights, you know, they're one of the earliest members of WGI. So it was big here. I mean, you know, back then you thought it was big. Now it's like big, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
but yeah, I was just gigging so much that I didn't end up doing any of that. But I was such a huge fan, and I would go watch groups rehearse. I took a couple of arranging lessons from Mike Nevin, who is, you know, kind of a legend in that activity. who happened to live in Denver. And then just, you know, went to PASIC and went to every clinic I could that was by somebody like Tom Hannum or Gasella, those kind of guys, and got a hold of scores, you know. Like I was telling somebody the other day, like back in the day, you used to be able to go to a show and you would go to the sous vide truck and they would have like the exercise packet or like a little piece of show music or whatever that you could buy from the sous vide truck. I mean, now that's kind of like all online. You can download it and stuff, but that's one way I learned. So it's all, yeah, it's a lot of just self-taught stuff.
No, that's great.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of, it works out for you because you can tell, you may not have the stories, but you made the income from the activity.
Right. Yeah. It's interesting how that whole like perception thing works in this field. Cause I definitely have people who've come to me who are at the drum corps even who, you know, our new staff members or something. And then they find out that I never marched and they're just like dumbfounded. But then I also we took our jazz band on a tour at CSU down to a high school. I've known this band director for a decade and I play a tune on vibes and I play a tune on drum set with the jazz band. Cause we're like featuring the faculty and stuff. And this band director comes up to me afterwards. He's like, I didn't know you played drum set. Like, I didn't know you could do jazz. I thought you were just a marching guy.
Of course.
And it's just so funny, you know, cause he just never seen me in that scene. I was like, well, I've been a jazz guy for way longer than I've been a marching guy, you know? It's just funny. If people don't see you doing a certain thing, they just assume either you can't, or you just do this one thing or whatever. And, it's fun.
I definitely hear you on that. Whenever I do marimba is my primary instrument. And whenever I do a recital, I usually do one a year just for my own fun, basically. But you get like students who are like, I know. I'm like, yeah, I know. Cause you're in my music history class or something. I'm like, yes. Right. But yes, I do other things. You correctly.
Yeah, exactly.
Like I can also chip out of bunkers. Well, so, you know, that's you, not me, but.
Oh, that's funny.
So what do you end up doing after you're done undergrad?
So I got done with my undergrad. I thought I might start my master's, but then changed my mind. I was teaching just like local drum lines and working at a coffee shop in town, doing gigs, just kind of doing the freelance thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then that kind of grew into getting an alternative teaching license.
Okay.
So I got an alternative teaching license and then became like the assistant band director at a local high school, which was only part time. So then I was still like writing for some other groups and still gigging a lot, playing with all the local symphonies. So yeah, kind of still like I was freelancing quite a bit really in some regard. I mean, I still do. We all do. Until I went back to get my master's. And then once I got my master's, like I kind of like reset again. And I basically told myself, I'm going to give myself 3 years to actually make it as like a drum person, like a drum guy, a drum instructor.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked out for me. And that's what I was doing for years. I was teaching at like three schools, and had like texts and stuff and doing a ton of writing, and then gigging a lot and doing my little tiny piece at CSU. And then my piece at CSU got bigger and bigger, and bigger until I couldn't do the high school thing anymore. To be honest, it had kind of burned out on it a little bit too, cause I was doing so much of it in
a
couple schools and stuff like that. So then I kind of switched my focus to CSU and that has worked out really great. And I stopped teaching high schools like totally like 3 years ago.
Mm.
So now I do quite a bit of judging, but I still do a lot of writing for schools and then CSU and playing. So, yeah.
Now, when you say drum instructor, were you doing private lessons too?
Yeah. So I was doing like private lessons. I was at two main schools where I was like considered the director of percussion, but that's not a district employee position in Colorado. Like that really doesn't exist. So it was all paid for by the boosters.
Yeah.
But I was there like, you know, twice a week or more, depending on the season and all that. And then private lessons, those are kind of like, yeah, the main things I was doing at those schools. And then overseeing my staff that was there, so.
And were you, these lessons at the schools or were they at your house?
Generally at the schools, yeah.
And go back, what did the alternative or alternative music teaching license?
So the
what is that? Why did you have to get that?
Well, since I had a performance degree, I didn't have an ed degree, so I wasn't licensed to teach.
Mm-hmm.
But you can get a sub license as long as you have a 4-year degree. So I got a sub license, which allowed me to teach for like a year.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a thing, an organization here in Colorado. I don't know if they still do this or not, because you know it was part of it was like there was a teacher shortage. So you could get this alternative license where you had a mentor come and work with you like once a month at least.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to go do lessons and like keep a journal and all this stuff. And then you would go like every other week and take like all day classes on Saturday. And then after a year you had a full teaching license, in the state of Colorado. And then, you know, you get your probationary teaching license. And then 3 years after that, you take some more classes and things like that, and you get your professional license. So it was just a faster, cheaper way to get a teaching license because I was into doing it, and it worked great. In the school that I was at, I was teaching basically just the jazz bands and percussion, and then I was teaching at the middle school as well. And then I did teach some choir as well. I taught the jazz choir, and I did teach the woman's choir because they needed somebody, and I was already there. And
yeah,
more money is cool. You know?
All right.
So
these kids are going to love Manhattan Transfer, is what you realized.
Yes.
Use that background to your advantage.
Well, actually, it's funny you bring that up, because when I was at UNC, I got to play drum set with the top vocal jazz groups there. And they had, especially back then, they still do, but there's some really great vocal jazz groups there. And actually, one of the guys I played with is the new baritone in the Manhattan Transfer.
Nice.
Yeah, so small world, right?
Yeah.
But I definitely knew like what the sound was supposed to be and how to get it, all that stuff. And I remember at a teacher conference one time, this mom comes up and like I had known her, and her student had taken some lessons with me and stuff. And she said, "I'm really mad at you." And I was like, "Oh," you know. And she said, "I can't believe you got my daughter to listen to Nat King Cole."
Okay.
And so then, you know, but she was like, "I've been trying for years to get her to listen to stuff like that. And one session, you know, in your class, and she's listening to that stuff." And I was like, "You were the best compliment ever," you know?
No kidding.
So.
Not that it should be hard to listen to Nat King Cole, but that's a different question.
Yeah, I mean, for a sophomore in high school, probably. I mean, when I was a sophomore in high school, I was like, I'm into it, but not it.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Was there like a breaking point when you realized that like you have these things that you've built up, particularly with the high schools, you realize that you actually need to give them up for your own sanity? Is that happens?
Yes, that 100% happened. Yes. Because it's two of the best programs in the state of Colorado, and I was running both of them. And luckily, they're only about 15 minutes apart, and I was living in one of the towns. So that part was easy. But I mean, when you're managing, you know, it's like 80 percussionists between the two schools, depending on the year, you know, probably 60 to 80 percussionists. That's a lot. And like I said, they were two of the most high profile, most competitive groups, you know, in the state. And I did have staff that helped me, obviously, but it was still, I just got to where I couldn't do it anymore.
Hopefully not to a point where you realize that like either you're just getting stretched out or the work was, I hope, like not slipping, but you just like maybe you're not eating as well or sleeping as well, like any of that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, it was definitely a tired thing, you know? And I did go to my doctor and like, I had high blood pressure, which is like a family thing too. But, he was like, "You need to, you know, think about some of this stuff." So yeah, I mean, I don't know if I was in I definitely didn't have the same attitude that I used to, you know, like I used to love teaching eight on a hand. And now I'm just like, I don't
know. Right. Someone else can do that.
Yeah. Some of the younger people who want to, who have that same attitude that I did, they can, they'll do better than I will, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was definitely like a mindset shift, but it was interesting, like being on the outside of it, like looking back too. Mm-hmm. When you're in the thing, you're just like, I'm just going to keep going. I can go to Starbucks or whatever. Like, yeah, you know, and then now I'm like, God, that was dumb. Like, live and learn.
There's a lot of, it's an expensive mocha frappe habit or something like that, probably.
Yeah, let's just say they know me. At
you park and they're starting to, it's like, no, we got this, Mr. Yeah. Stroman. It's all taken care of.
Yeah. 100% true. Yeah.
Not nearly a Cheers Shiloh, like not that necessarily, but
well, at one of the Starbucks I go to, it is kind of like that because they're fun people in there, and I walk through the door and they're like, yeah, fun.
That's awesome. What point in all of this do you start doing the masters? Is that like, and are you doing that just kind of piece by piece, like on a slower pace?
So I was teaching, you know, like part-time at this school in Loveland, which is another little city close to Fort Collins. And I just decided that I wanted to go back full-time actually and get my my master's with Eric. kind of like at that point I was kind of done teaching the high school full-time, like, or part-time, like as an actual teacher, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. You know, and like things like faculty meetings, and it was just kind of a lot of doom and gloom and things at that point in that specific district. Mm. The kids were still great. There was just a lot of, you know, other.
Yeah.
So I was like, I need to make a change, and wanted to work on my playing on some certain things and stuff like that too. So went back full time. I was only teaching at one school at that point. And it was a brand new school, so it was a really tiny program. I didn't have to do a lot yet, but we were kind of building that program to what it is today. So that's the only thing I was really doing while in grad school.
When you're doing your master's full time, do you already notice that it's different because Eric's there, because there's kind of like this new regime, as you're mentioning, is kind of in place and things are progressing in a different manner?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Some really great students in the percussion studio at that point. The bands were getting better. The marching band was getting better. The orchestra actually was getting better too. Because like all of those people, you know, were new. All of that faculty was coming in and new. Yeah. It was cool to kind of be a part of the uphill climb, you know?
When you take lessons from Eric, what do you feel like he's trying to get out of you? What does he see as the things that are going to make you kind of push you to the next step?
Well, actually, when I went to grad school, I made a list.
Oh, all right.
Of everything I wanted to tackle. Mm-hmm. I knew what his strengths were and his background and things. And so I literally just gave him that list like the first day of classes, and we just kind of went through that list. So a lot of excerpts, because I had really done none of that. Really in undergrad, I've been playing in orchestras, cause we have three kind of regional orchestras that you can play in up here. So I learned a lot of them that way, like on the job training. But then I really wanted to learn like the different ways, different, you know, schools play them and all that kind of thing, and, different takes on them and gear and all that. And then obviously marimba, I'd never learned the octave pop until Eric taught it to me.
I'm sorry, the what?
Like the octave pop, you know, the Stevens octave pop.
Oh, the grip. Gotcha. Okay. I never heard it referred to that, but I know what you mean. Yeah.
I'd never learned that in undergrad. And I was like, this is like a game changer, you know, the sound on marimba, which Eric was way into, and obviously through technique and some things. And then timpani too, obviously through excerpts. So those are the things I really wanted to focus on. Got, you know, my snare drum stuff together a little bit more with the orchestral way of playing. Because I have such a rudimental player, I remember being like, I do remember one of my first snare drum lessons with Eric. He was like, why do you action at the end of every roll? And I kind of had like an Art Blakey buzz roll, to be honest, too, you know, like, because that was in my ear. And then playing like a lot of rudimental snare drum, like a Pratt solos and stuff like that. So he changed my touch and my sound and stuff like that as far as snare drum was concerned as well. So, I mean, it was, and then percussion ensemble with him was like so amazing. I love percussion ensemble music. That's one thing I miss that I don't get to play a lot, you know? But learning percussion ensemble, like we did Third Construction and Threads had kind of just come out. Some Threads, and that was like so amazing too, because I had never had an experience like that at all anywhere else until Eric. So like basically everything that I had not done was there with Eric, which was awesome.
Now, do you remember some of what you played on your master's recital?
Yeah. So I did, that was kind of the first iteration of my band. So we did some of my originals. And then I played the Carter March on one of the recitals, and the second rotation. I played the Masson concert stook for snare drum, the concerto kind of.
I don't know if I know that. Okay.
It's really cool. It's written for full orchestra, but we did a version that Lisa Pager kind of hipped us to, which is with percussion and then piano.
Okay.
It's kind of like percussion ensemble, piano, and then solo snare drum. Yeah. And we have an amazing piano player at CSU. He's actually the organ professor, but he's an amazing piano player too. So that was cool. The Ravel, it's a piano piece, obviously, but it's for two marimbas. We did that duet. Alborado.
I know what you're talking about. Gracioso or something like that?
Yes, that thing.
Okay.
These are like, I'm having to push all the way back from my head.
Yeah.
But we did that as a duet, which was with another grad student, and that was super fun. And I think that's all I did. I'm trying to remember all the other stuff. Yeah. But those I remember.
Once you're done with the master's, is that when you start getting to teach there?
Yeah, I started literally the next fall just teaching like the drum set people, basically. I was teaching two of the high schools, I think, at that point, and maybe writing for three, something like that, and then doing some playing. And that kind of kept me going, you know, financially.
Sure, yeah. As you're starting to get more or more people know who you are, maybe at Colorado State, they start saying, oh, you know, there's this opportunity for you to do these jazz classes, or they had been taught and then you were starting to get to take them over. What was the kind of the process there?
So like my lessons kind of, I got more and more lesson time, and then the marching band thing came next because Eric wanted to just really focus on the studio, because it was, you know, we always are right around 20 people in the studio. And then all the percussion ensemble stuff, so that all came first. And then we had a faculty member who was teaching like jazz pedagogy, jazz piano, and maybe like one of the combos or something like that. He got a job. So they had to fill that. And so that's one of the ways I got into that part of the system, if you will. And then that's kind of grown from there for various reasons. Yeah.
You being good at your job is, I'm going to assume, one of those reasons.
Well, I like to think so, yes.
Okay, I'm going to move on to our final segment, random ask questions.
Sure.
And first question, which is not random, is what's an issue in percussion education? And you can, we'll ask you this for jazz education too, but percussion education that most gets under your skin or drives you the most nuts?
Well, when I go out and judge, when I see accessory instruments played poorly, it drives me crazy. And mainly because, you know, in the same ensemble, I might see the snare drums playing like the craziest hybrid rudiments really well.
Yeah.
And then they're holding the triangle with the shoestring and playing it with like a, you know, a screwdriver or something. And I'm like, how are those two things in the same ensemble?
Right. You know?
So that's definitely one thing that drives me crazy with percussion education that I see quite a bit. And even in the concert band setting, you know, like, I don't think band directors always realize how much damage a poor suspended cymbal roll can do to your band.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It can do a lot.
Suspended cymbal, too. I mean, not right. The wrong cymbal as well as a bad roll.
Right, exactly. Like, just putting, and that's a clinic that I do a lot for various organizations and things, but yeah, just, those are, yeah, just play the orc. Play them like they're really instruments, you know? And then in jazz wise, a couple things kind of bother me. There's not enough jazz being played. When I go to festivals, you know, there's not enough Basie or Ellington or just even playing straight ahead tunes that are arranged by a modern arranger even, you know, but like the standard repertoire is not being performed enough at the high school level. There's a lot of just rock and pop stuff being played, and that's not what jazz is, you know. So that would be a big one in that regard that I see quite a bit.
It's interesting to say that. I mean, your jazz background in terms of lit was necessarily for that you were playing in bands. I remember when I was in high school that we would do, I mean, we kind of had like the Basie, the Nestico, like all like the kind of the classic mm-hmm. kind of high school charts kind of thing. And then the chart that everyone wanted to play was like the funk 70s arrangement, you know, like Brass Machine or Get It On or Vehicle or, you know, like things like that.
Yeah.
So is it that like they've gone like so far away from the first part of that maybe? That like they're playing like rock, like you're saying, rock arrangements or.
Yeah. If you're doing like a 4-song set and 3 of those tunes are the other.
Oh, right. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, you're not teaching your kids the art form. And they maybe don't even really, they think they know what the art form is, but that's not it. One of the guys I was judging with at a festival this fall, he was working with a band on stage and he asked them like, hey, do you guys know the Kind of Blue record by Miles Davis? And like a couple of kids raised their hands and he basically said, well, actually he said this, he's like, if you don't like that record, you don't like jazz. which was kind of, you know, we were kind of like, oh, I can't believe it. But I mean, it's true. It's like, if you really want to like the art form, you have to dig a little deeper, you know? Now, granted, there's all these modern players like Robert Glasper and Kamasi and those types of people who are playing music that, you know, doesn't swing or has like maybe some different harmonies or something. And that's the evolution of the music, which is great. But you have to know, but those guys know where it came from.
Right.
Because you can still hear it in their playing that they know where it came from. But I mean, I see so many groups who don't even understand how to swing, which to be honest is really, really hard. It's really, really hard to teach even college kids how to swing. Like yeah. That's something that I'm just adamant about. Like, I don't care if they play wrong notes or out of tune, to be honest with you sometimes, but the rhythm and the style and the feel better be happening.
Yeah.
Cause if it's not, then that's really not the music, you know? Like if you listen to some of the greatest artists, they don't always play in tune and stuff, but it's swinging.
Right.
And that's, I'd rather listen to that.
Yeah.
So yeah. Soapbox. No,
that's great. We, the jazz professor at Mizzou and I are frequently, he's got like his I don't know, like standard call jazz phrase. That's like what he says. I won't say what it is just because I'll protect his identity in case he's done to other people. But, you know, we'll come up with like a skippity boo or, you know, like what's your, you know, like what your standard a shuba shuba or what, you know, like all that kind of stuff.
Gong is one of my favorite bass ones. Flickety gong.
Oh, wait, what is it?
Flickety gong.
Flickety gong. Nice.
Yeah.
We enjoy it.
Package of gum.
Yeah. Oh, I like that.
Yeah.
Package of gum. Nice. the other thing is I've talked to a couple other people who play jazz, and they've said, talking about how when they were first starting to kind of learn, basically, like, you know, not just play what they think is jazz. One of the first lessons they would have is the guy would be like, okay, he'd name like four drummers to be like, how did they play this? And if the guy didn't know the answer, he'd be like, okay, if you don't answer that the next time, we're not having this anymore.
Yep. You know, I will, this is not to be like old grumpy guy, get off my lawn kind of thing. I notice it's hard with even the students at CSU sometimes to get them to really listen and to really know what the people on the record and the name of the tunes, you know, like the details that we all grew up doing, because we would get the CD and like look at the liner notes and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
But man, once you convince a kid, like it's all on the records, man, it's all there. And once they get over that bump, boy, they get better. Like their trajectory of improvement is unbelievable, but it takes sometimes a long time to convince students that that's where all the information is. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, great way to say it. All right. We're going to hit a few other questions. What is the most impractical item of clothing you own?
The most impractical item of clothing?
Yeah.
Like, why do I own this? It's not comfortable. It's not useful. That kind of thing.
Sure. Any of those. Yeah.
I mean, I've got a couple pair of shoes that I think are sweet, but they're not super comfortable. I know. I guess that would be.
That's your answer.
Yeah.
All right. Go to a few others here. Has anyone ever nailed an impression of you? And if so, how'd they do it?
Oh man. I mean, I've definitely had, you know, like when they do dress up day at like high school marching band or whatever, that tends to be a thing for Spirit Week or something like that.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh.
There's always some kid that dresses up like me, you know, mm-hmm. And it's typically like a golf polo.
Right. Yeah.
Maybe flip flops and like a hat or whatever it might be. Cause when you're in marching band, that's what you wear, you know?
Right.
And then I'm known quite a bit, especially in the percussion and jazz worlds at school for puns. I love puns.
Ooh.
Yeah. And to the kids' dismay or rejoice, you know, depending. Yeah. But that's definitely something I think they would try to do to, yeah, and make an impression or impersonation of me. Yeah.
Mm. So they'd see you, like you're wearing a hat right now. It's like, it must be Hatter Day, like that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And you just like you, and you, if they groan, you're like, Oh yeah. You're just giving me more fuel for the fire.
If a kid says a pun, they're like, oh, that sounds like something that Shiloh would say, you know? Yeah.
Nice. All right. What is a great movie and what is a terrible movie?
Well, terrible movie is, that's one with like Ashton Kutcher and, Dude, Where's My Car?
Oh no.
It's almost like so terrible that it's good.
No, that's what it is. It's so terrible that it's good. Oh, yeah. You just think it's terrible?
I don't know if that counts. But anymore, if a movie's terrible, I just shut it off. So
I
don't remember them anymore. I guess that would count. A great movie. I love White Christmas. I love that movie.
Like the old Bing Crosby thing?
Yeah.
Wow. All right.
I love High Fidelity, which was a book first.
Yeah. Yeah.
I love the Before After Sunset, if you know that trilogy.
I
think he's one of my favorite filmmakers.
Linklater.
Yeah. Yeah. His whole concept of like time and how it evolves and all that, I think is very interesting.
So you're a fan of Boyhood then?
Yeah. Oh my gosh. What a crazy concept, man. Like it took a lot of determination and like, you know, planning and patience and wow. But yeah, what a cool idea. Yeah.
Relatedly, what's something that, maybe thinking more obscure pop culture-y, that if you meet someone and they say, I like this, and you're like, we're good. What's that for you?
Boy, that's a really interesting question. I mean, obviously some movies would do that. And some bands would do that. I mean, from my generation, if they love like Tori Amos or something like that, that would be, you know, like that's kind of a rare, not everybody knows who that is kind of thing. I love the movie Swingers. Like there's just so many great one-liners that like only me and my friends will kind of pass back and forth from that movie.
You're so money and you don't even know it.
Exactly. I don't know. Those aren't really great examples, but
it might just be that when you said like you're around other high school students who knew who Hart Blakey was,
right.
That could be it.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I think for me that would be something that would totally be in the moment. I'd be like, yes, but I can't think of it right now because everything, like all the CDs behind me and stuff like that, like that's stuff that is around me all the time, so I don't think of it as being weird or...
Sure, yeah.
No, but... Yeah, but I understand that question. I think it's cool. It's interesting.
What is your biggest kitchen mess up?
Well, I have one from when I was working at a coffee shop.
If that counts. Yeah.
We used to make Italian sodas as well.
Okay.
So we had like a giant jar of maraschino cherries.
Mm-hmm.
It hadn't been opened yet, so it's full.
Uh-huh.
I'm trying to get the top off and it slips out of my hands and like breaks and the entire floor is covered in maraschino cherries and sauce.
Right. Of course.
So it was like sticky for weeks. I mean, in some ways that would be like my greatest kitchen.
Yeah. Turns out doesn't come up easily.
No, it was absolutely the worst.
Oh. Yeah. Probably find like a cherry, you know, like 4 months later is like,
you know,
machine.
Forever to the floor. Yeah. That'd probably be it.
Yeah. Where is somewhere that you have not traveled to that you still want to get to?
I'd love to go to Scotland and play golf.
Of course, yeah.
I've been to Ireland. I haven't played golf there yet, but, and then I'd love to go just to more European, countries like Germany and France. I've never been there. Just England and Ireland are all I've been to. So I'd love to do more of that for sure.
What is your best non-life-threatening injury?
Like just one I got stupidly or?
Yeah. Or it could. Yeah, sure. Or something that you got with a good story, maybe a good story behind it or.
So I was into skateboarding as a high school kid, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's a month before our high school band trip in the summer.
Okay.
And we lived on this big hill and I've been going up and down it kind of like all afternoon and I'm like one more time and I'm going to try and like do this massive ollie, right?
Mm-hmm.
I totally fall and break my arm. And luckily my sister was there with our goat cart. So she drove me back to our house and we went to the hospital. And I mean, it wasn't crazy broken, but it was broken enough to where I had to have a cast and all that good stuff. And so I couldn't, and it was my left arm, of course. So I couldn't, you know, work on my left hand.
Right. Yeah.
But the cast got off like a week before our band trip kind of thing. And yeah, or maybe days before, I can't remember at this point, but cause that was a long time ago, but that was just kind of a dumb, because the drumline was really not happy with me as we were about to go. And I couldn't even go to practice, really. I mean, I could go in March, but couldn't.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
You were a little, you had some work to do, is what you're saying, when the cast came off.
Yeah. I had to rehab it really quickly. And thankfully, like I said, it wasn't that big of a break. And I was young, so I was only a sophomore in high school, something like that. So it was, like, easy to kind of, you know, rebound.
Yeah. Yeah. Was that the end of your skateboarding career?
Somewhat. Yeah. I still
pause.
Somewhat, but I would still go out. My nephew really got into skateboarding a few years ago. And so I kind of got back into it because he lives in Southern California, kind of where all those guys live. Like my sister sees Tony Hawk at a grocery store. Like, So I bought another skateboard. Like they came out retro wise with the one that I had, my very first skateboard. They came out with them again as like a retro thing for all us people who are like trying to relive our youth, you know?
Of course. Yeah.
So I bought one and I would putt around with him a little bit, but I'm totally afraid to like do any tricks and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Gotcha. That one of my students told me a while ago that, I think, Jerry was a race car driver is on the Tony Hawk Pro Sport. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. It's on one
video game.
One of those early versions. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Cause I was playing that song for him. It's like, listen to double bass. He's like, wait, this is Tony Hawk.
I saw Primus in high school at CSU in the ballroom.
Nice.
Yeah. So like it was like right before Sailing This Seas of Cheese came out.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody knew who they were. They weren't on the Bill and Ted's thing yet, you know?
Yeah.
So it was a really tiny venue. So it was really cool to see those guys live. And then I saw Tim at a drum clinic one time too. Tim Alexander. So, yep.
All right. Couple more. What is either the strangest, funniest, or weirdest performance moment that involves you?
When I was teaching at this school in Loveland, when I was like, I was a halftime teacher, but you know what I mean? We got a request to do like a community event for the manager of an Albertsons, which is
a grocery store, right?
Grocery store. Yep, exactly. And he was getting an award from the military because he was such a good boss to let his employee out for, what do they call it? The reserves or whatever, something like that. So we get to the gig with the marching band and we're thinking this is outside. There's going to be like a stage outside, whatever. Oh no, they put us in the produce section. Oh, God. So literally like the drum line is, you know, like right near the cabbage or whatever. I don't remember what it was, but we put the whole marching band like in that produce section and played, I don't know, some pep band tune or something. And there was a picture of it that ended up making like national, like the AP wire or whatever, just cause it was so bizarre to see a marching band in the produce section of this grocery store. But that's a weird one.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, probably like grab an apple, like as a snack while you're, in between songs or something like that.
The part was just the average shopper who was there didn't know what was going on. And they're like, what are these children doing in marching band uniforms? It's like, yeah. And it was so loud, obviously too, but
oh yeah.
Yeah. Funny.
Does not seem like it would have brought in business necessarily, while you were there.
Yeah, probably not for those 20 minutes or so that we were playing.
Yeah. Someone's just sitting there like, I really want to get to the oranges, please.
Exactly. So bizarre.
That's hilarious. All right. And lastly, Shiloh, what one piece of art, whether it's music, movies, books, podcasts, YouTube clips, theater, visual art, poetry, anything, et cetera, has impacted you the most recently?
You know, once the pandemic hit, I did try to get more reading in. So I read On the Road by Kerouac.
Oh, yeah.
And that's really great. And it talks about a lot of parts of Denver and stuff that are like, I understand exactly where he's talking about and stuff. So that was really cool. I've watched the Abstract series on Netflix. If you haven't seen those, check those out.
No, I don't. What is that?
Oh, man. So there's two seasons of it. And they basically follow like a creative around. So there's like a Nike shoe designer. There's a stage like production person for, you know, like Broadway shows and things like that. There's like graphic artists. There's, you know, so each episode is like a different person that they follow. And there's this one artist, I'll probably slaughter his name, but it's like Olafur Eliasson. He does these really crazy, kind of like big, installations.
Okay.
Really interesting. Just the way he kind of sees the world is very interesting. Those have been two things somewhat recently that are really fascinating.
When you were reading On the Road, did it take a while to just kind of like get the pace? It's a When I read it, I just remember I was like, I may need to just start over because I can't, I'm struggling to keep up here.
Yeah, it's interesting. That book felt very easy for me to read.
Okay.
But then I'm trying to read Leaves of Grass by Walt Whitman.
Mm.
So hard. Like really, really hard for me. And that's been kind of interesting because I wasn't like a reader in high school or college, really. So it's been a fairly recent thing. In the past couple of decades, I've gotten into reading more. And it is interesting how different that is, you know. But I guess it's just like any art. You know, there are certain kinds of music that I'm like, nah, I don't really dig that. And other kinds that just I relate to immediately. But yeah, it is interesting because you would think like the English language is universal to us, obviously. But man, it's different. Yeah. Like Emily Dickinson too. I tried to get into, I can't digest that very fast, but On the Road, I digested really fast. I read, Vonnegut's, The Slaughterhouse-Five.
Yeah.
I read that really quickly. That like made me, but yeah, other things I really struggle.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting.
Have you read Catch 22? That's another like in that same kind of realm where it's, like that was one that like kind of similar to you when you were reading On the Road where I got it, the pace, I understood the language and it's wonderful.
Okay.
Certainly recommend that as like if you're kind of getting into some of the classics.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
Yeah, I'll check that out.
So great to meet and chat with Shiloh. I wish him all the best for the new year and hope that we get a chance to chat for real in person one of these days. This week's rave is the classic 1986 graphic novel Watchmen by Alan Moore and David Gibbons. In 2005, when Time magazine created its greatest 100 English language novels since 1923, which is the date of their founding, that's why that date is picked, Watchmen was the only graphic novel on the list. At the time, I had never read a graphic novel and likely had a very low opinion of the genre, of which I knew practically nothing. Straight ignorance. Fair to say that I was blown away back then when I first read it 10 plus years ago and very much enjoyed it a second time through very recently. The story is told in somewhat of an alternate history that looks at the dissolution of a group of crime fighters from the 1940s and 50s through death, disparity, divorce, natural causes, and unknown reasons. The group is brought back together to try and stop one of their ex-members from destroying the world, and it unspools in that fashion. Part of the genius of this work is through the use of multiple storytelling lines and sources throughout the novel. The authors create not only the usual comic strip format that one might be used to seeing in a graphic novel, but places lots of outside sources like fake book excerpts, magazine articles, correspondence between characters, found materials, etc., somewhat as if an outside researcher was putting together the history of this group for a book. The novel also employs constantly moving storylines and non-linear time frames. There's an enormous amount of backstory and back and forth from the past to the present day, and it even involves a character who is reading another type of graphic novel during the graphic novel. So there's all these layers within. In one of the best sequences in this entire work, the backstory of the character Dr. Manhattan is presented, but has done so with complete disregard for time. It moves in such a chaotic fashion, back to the present, to the past, to the back past, back and forth, to give you a sense of what it's like when time is immaterial, as it is for that character. It is completely brilliant. This is well worth your time and has been made into both a movie from about 10 years ago, as well as a highly regarded HBO series from last year. But it's always worth it to delve back into the original, so check out the original comic, Watchmen. And that's our show. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and leave a comment and a rating. The show is always found with all of its episodes and the show notes at the homepage at petezambito.com/Pete's Percussion Podcast, the episodes, as well as on Spotify. You can also find these shows on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Player FM, and many other podcast locations. If you're on Facebook, like the page Pete's Percussion Podcast. You can find me there on Instagram and Twitter at Pete Zambito or by email at petesperkpod@gmail.com, and I'll catch you next time. Until then.